I don't think anyone hears me. I unmuted it. Oh, okay. All right, so you're just ignoring me. I have self-esteem issues already, and you can't do that. I don't know what that is. Oh, it's Sonic the Hedgehog. Okay, so I'm going to try this, and I don't know that any of these classes that are up on the screen, if anyone will fit into a single session, or if maybe three will fit into a single session, but that's kind of my plan, and class number two, it's just kind of an idea that, you know, I have a theology of creativity, and I've never really tried to put it all together as a presentation. And so that will be next week. And then the third class will just kind of be looking at poetic techniques. And then the fourth class, examining the way reading places us in part of a greater tradition, and then maybe we'll have a class or two after that where we're just looking at poetry. So it kind of, this class kind of has two introductions this week and next week, and in a minute I was hoping to that you would share. Maybe the first time you encountered a poem or a poem that struck you as meaningful and share from that experience. And I have these thoughts that, because, you know, at the beginning of the Bible, when God is creating, he creates using his speech. He says, let there be light, and there's light, and, you know, let the seas have fish. And he says, let us make humankind in our image. And that's a really unique moment when he creates humans, because of all the things God creates, the human is the only of the speech creatures that he speaks directly to. And you can see, he says, God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply. And Nolan, if you don't mind scrolling up a little bit, the slides are a little rusher today. God said, I have given you every plant yielding seed and its fruit. You shall have them for food. The human is the only creature that God speaks to and calls you. There is this conversational relationship at play, an intimacy that God has with humans that he doesn't have with light or fish. So the human, of all the speech creatures, is the best. It's the truest speech creature. And not only does God speak to us, he grants us the ability to respond. And I think that this ability to respond is uniquely present in poetry, in all forms of discourse that we're going to have their unique aspects. But poetry is perhaps, I think, something that puts us in a position to explore the world and the universe in a way that maybe a news article doesn't. And, you know, we live in a time where unique speaking is important, because we live in an age of resurrection. Jesus rose from the dead. We live in an age in which the migrant and the immigrant, the alien, should find home. the widow and widower, the orphan, they should find family. Unfortunately, it does not seem that the emperors and the powers of this age recognize what time it is. And, you know, they squabble over minerals and islands and whatever else. So it's kind of in this context that I want to examine poetry as a tool for Christians, both reading and writing, in a way that we can examine a passing age and proclaim a vision for a coming age. Nolan, can you slide that down some more? Oh yeah, I was when I said ability to respond, I was going to push that, and it was. All right. So, if any of you has had a meaningful interaction with a poem, I think that would be a great starting place. And in a few minutes, I have one that I'm going to share, but I'd rather not start.
Completely perplexed, had no idea what this guy was talking about. And then I think the one poet that really has meant a lot to me was Maya Angelou, her work.
Couple come to mind. I'm a big fan of the movie Dead Poets Society. So
that's an understatement.
and then I came across at least a section of a poem by T.S. Eliot in an art magazine used to talk about an artist, but and I don't remember the exact words, but basically saying, you know, we're gonna travel and experience, and the result of all of our travels will be to end up where we started and know the place for the very first time. That just has resonated with me ever since I read that. So,
while it's here, you know, I've always been drawn to the lyrics of music, which is poetry. And when I was about 8, I read E.E. Cummings. And that fascinated me. Number one, that he never uses a capital letter. I just thought, this is rebellion. And then there was just something that resonated to me in my little heart. and then I remember just being pursuing it more and more and realizing that it could be a voice for dissent, not just rebellion, but dissent. And so, like in my teens, I loved a lot of poets. I was going to name one, and his name just left my mind. But my sister made so much fun of it that I realized, I mean, I didn't realize, I just came to believe that I couldn't pursue it.
So there's two little moments of both diametrically opposite. When I was in like third grade, the author of a book of scary poems for children came to my school and read them to us. And I was enamored. Like, I started writing horror stories and horror poems, and my fourth grade teacher had to put a ban on writing horror because after I started doing it, then all of the other kids started doing it, and our entire class was just full of blood and guts, and like, and you know, to this day, that lives on. but then when I was in college, my two housemates and I we decided to create an event. It was called the In Celebration of Women event, and it was going to be the first of its kind at our university. And we went through and we had a wall in our house where we taped things up, because it was just a big old ugly rental house. And we took poems and we would cut out poems and like tape them to the wall. And they were in our house forever. And there was one that we ended up choosing to put on the back of the t-shirts that we had made, or a clip from it, from Rainer Maria Rilke, who we took a phrase from one of his poems, and like that was the theme for our In Celebration of Women. Which kind of ironic that it was a man's quote from our, but also because, you know, women need supportive men to be feminists. But that was a really cool thing that we had, just this wall lived in our house of poetry all year. And then that, like, we pulled that out for a really special thing that we did.
I cannot go to school today, said little Peggy Ann McKay. Shel Silverstein was my first introduction. And I think I got stuck there because I just love children's poetry, and I used it in my classroom to help with fluency and intonation and exaggeration and just being ridiculous, and so it's super fun that way. And then I couldn't get into poetry at all. Like, I really struggled. And then I realized lyrics to songs are poetry as well, and so that was kind of where I got stuck.
Cheryl's next. Can you get Cheryl?
Hi, I was going to share my ideas, but as you were quoting that, my 6-year-old granddaughter says, I know that poem. My kindergarten teacher read it in my first grade teacher. So, so that's kind of cool. I think my earliest thing with poems, honestly, was probably nursery rhymes, and I loved the repetitive nature of it. I didn't understand all the words. And then going into adolescence, it was definitely Dylan and Peter, Paul, and Mary, and, you know, grew up during the Vietnam War, so those songs and words had a big meaning for me. And I just, I love all that stuff, all the words. That's all I have to say. Right. Thanks.
That's kind of funny because, well, anyway, you'll see. So A.A. Milne, the author of Winnie the Pooh. So as somebody who really struggled to read as a small child, there was something, and just with everything that was going on in my home and in my life, there was something about that world that just enamored me, and still to this day, I collect Piglet. You want to make me happy, give me a Winnie the Pooh quote. I still to this day, it's one of my favorites, and it just resonates on a very deep level. And so anyway, I loved the world. I loved, in my mind, the poems, the little quotes. It was more, less about the stories and more about some of the just small moments that one of the characters would say. And I just would repeat that over and over and over again, because my sister would read Winnie the Pooh to me. As I got older and just said, well, I guess I'm never going to be able to read these. I guess I'm never going to be able to write these, and cast it aside and said, I'm stupid. I fell in love with Peter, Paul, and Mary. And I had two albums that I would just listen to on repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat. And I would say that they became my guides, fifth grade through high school. Well, then I found U2 and REM. But I fell in love with really good lyrics. And I remember being made fun of by some of the other kids my age, because the songs that I liked, or I was very into alternative, and that was just, there wasn't a whole lot of us. But I didn't like bubblegum music. I wanted something that made me think, and if I couldn't get that from books, I found it in song.
Thank you.
I was also going to say Shel Silverstein was probably my first, probably thanks to Mr. Coburn. but now it's Mary Oliver and Sarah Bareilles. I just feel Mary Oliver is so, I feel seen. I feel known when I read her poems. I feel like I know God a little bit. And then Sarah Bareilles just says things that I'm like, I had no idea I felt that. She's amazing.
I grew up in front of a hi-fi with a Peter, Paul, and Mary album playing over and over and over again. I remember a song about a horse, and I knew every word to that song when I was 5 years old. And I remember playing on the playground the first time I heard the band playing a song about the winter of 65. We were hungry and just barely alive, and I felt like I'd read a book, you know.
Back in the 60s, my parents were children of the Depression, and 40 years later, when they had myself, my younger brother, we didn't have a lot of books in the house. I'm trying to think of the books that we had. I know that they bought an encyclopedia set for us, and then my mom's had like a book club, and for a dollar, you know, to start you off, they would send you, you could pick 7 or 8 books out of this catalog. And then after that, once a month, they would send a catalog, and she would let me look at that. And I always chose the poetry books. And one of my first books, I still have it, it's thick and green, The Best Love Poems of the American People. And there's so many little torn pieces of paper that I've stuck in throughout my life. If you can trust yourself when all men doubt you. Two roads diverged, yellow wood. You know, there's just so many that I have pieces of. And then in my teenage years, and since then, I can't tell you how many times, over 20, I've read the books of The Lord of the Rings and the poetry that that's infused with, and the songs.
I remember feeling like the very first time I was connected to poetry was when my friend Lainey, we were probably 12 or 13, but she loved writing poetry. And so when she would write a poem, she would always read it to me. And that was kind of the first like awareness I had of like creatively putting words together so they rhyme. But I think personally, becoming aware of Langston Hughes, particularly, he wrote a poem called Cross, which is about being biracial, and so that really was meaningful for me personally. And Maya Angelou has a poem called Phenomenal Woman, which I still read probably, you know, 4 times a year. It's just, it's phenomenal.
Right. Anyone else? Oh, there we go.
I had a 7th grade lit teacher that was National Teacher of the Year. She had, you have to read so many pages. And I went, oh, I hate reading. And she said, I don't care what you read. You can read cartoons. You can read poetry. And I went, poetry, there's lots of white space on that. And so that began my foray into poetry. My dad loved poetry, but one day in class, she read the words to Blackbird. And she said, did you know that poetry is the basis for most song? And then she played the Beatles. And as she was leading me along, I wasn't familiar with the Beatles singing that, and I could not imagine this poem being a song. But it just opened my world to the confluence of the verbal arts.
Kristen, and then me.
So I definitely was involved in theater before poetry, and so Shakespeare was the first kind of avenue, I think, to understand that that just something so magical about telling a story in verse, and just the cleverness of Shakespeare really drew me in. So.
The first time I ever wanted to be a writer was I was in fourth grade, and it was Halloween, and we had a writing assignment to write a ghost story, and you know the paper was shaped like a bat, and so I still have the story, and it's you know it's like something a kid in Western Oklahoma would write. There's like cowboys and ghosts and a boot hill, and because my teacher was so proud of it, and I'd never felt like I'd made a teacher proud, and you know the teachers were always proud of the kids who were good at basketball or baseball, and so I just like, oh wow, I could do this. Nolan, can you scroll to the next slide, please? So in 10th grade, I moved from rural Oklahoma to suburban Oklahoma City, and they had a big school with a creative writing program, and I did 3 years of creative writing there, and that's really when I first was introduced to poetry, and this poem by E.E. Cummings, which is among my top five all-time favorite poems, was what struck me, because before that I wanted to be a horror writer. I read Stephen King, and that's the stuff I turned in were like these short stories of people just being mauled I didn't understand why that made my parents uncomfortable, but I think they liked it better than when I started writing poetry, though. But I want to read this poem. Buffalo Bill's defunct, who used to ride a water smooth silver stallion and break 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pigeons just like that. Jesus, he was a handsome man. And what I want to know is, how do you like your blue-eyed boy, Mr. Death? I think at the time, the only poem I knew was The Raven. And my idea of poetry was, you know, like sonnets or, you know, something very orderly. And this poem was all over the page. Words were smashed together, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You can't read those slowly. These are the shots of a gun. And it was just so bizarre because there's a lot of space, and the grammar is weird. The syntax is weird. Buffalo Bill's defunct. Nobody says that. But I think I know what he means. You know, he's dead. Not as good as he used to be. You know, and I remember my teacher saying, you know, asking, what about this line? How do you like your blue-eyed boy? And all of us in the class were just like, I guess it's a good line. And she told us how Buffalo Bill was known for his gorgeous, piercing blue eyes. But I'm curious what your response is to this poem. Does it invoke anything or leave you with a question? Maybe just annoys you?
It's hard to articulate, but I think like he was larger than life when he was non-defunct, maybe, but now he's not so large.
If I would have read this in high school, I would not have liked it, because I like orderly things, things that make sense. And a lot of times, you know, poetry doesn't necessarily make sense in the way that other things make sense. But having been married to you for 20 years, I've come to appreciate that. And it is something that...
A lot of things there that don't make sense.
Yeah. Yeah, it is something that I could appreciate now and spend time, you know, thinking about. And, you know, what does it mean to have the words the way that they are on the page and smushed together and spread out and such?
Take a number.
Well, I love E.E. Cummings. I love that he doesn't play by the rules. And but what I get, the feeling that I have from this poem is here was this man who was beautiful and who could shoot like anything and rode a beautiful silver stallion, but he ends up dead like everybody else. Mm-hmm.
It's funny that you pulled this one out. I was a junior in high school the first time I ever saw this, and I'm going to be real, I was pissed. I was mad. I was so mad that my English teacher used it as an expression, because I don't know how many of y'all, well, I don't want to say other people. That's the way I read words with dyslexia. That's what it looks like on the paper, and that's what I've been told my entire life was wrong with me. And now we're celebrating somebody who did that. And I remember having an issue with E.E. Cummings, because this isn't the only poem that he breaks the rules. And I just remember, I mean, I remember the day, I can smell the classroom. As soon as I saw that, man, I smelled the classroom. It pissed me off. It still, I mean, I appreciate it. I can be like, well, I can hear the words now and I can think about the meanings. But it still pisses me off, because why is this person celebrated for breaking the rules? And when I was persecuted. And so that's, anyway, I have a complicated thing. But the words now I can be, I'm like, yeah, it makes sense to me. It makes sense why he put all those words together. It makes sense. That's the way my brain thinks. That's what it wants to do. And then I'm like, okay, cool. Let's celebrate that. I don't know if that's...
It makes me want to know whose point of view it's coming from. Mm-hmm. You know, who it is that's being like, oh, you know, mm-hmm. he was this guy, and but how do you like your blue-eyed boy now, Mr. Death? The little smarmy, sarcastic line at the end. Like, I want to know who's saying that and who he's saying it to.
Okay, I just leaned over to Sarah and said the same thing, like, how do you like your blue-eyed boy, Mr. Death? Like, this, he was an instrument of death in so many ways as a human at times, and it wasn't just pigeons that he shot, right? And so was this an offering to Mr. Death? Or, like, you know, whose instrument was Buffalo Bill? Like, that's kind of where my mind went. And so it was like, here you go, Death. How do you like him now? Like,
yeah.
Yeah. when I first saw this, first of all, E.E. Cummings was always hard for me as well, because I was orderly, is more my way. But being creative, I've always felt I was somewhat creative, but not so much with words. So it's interesting to me. But when I heard this, when you read it, it's so strange. It's like a stream of consciousness. All of a sudden, Jesus, he's a handsome man in the midst of this. And I think what I see in this is a sort of memorial. And so they're drawing, you're talking about the person who's defunct, and you bring in Jesus into that and death into that. And so to me, it's a sort of memorial. If I went to a memorial service for Buffalo Bill, what would be said maybe about him? And then bring up Jesus in the midst of that.
I think I first saw this when I was in grade school. And I was interested in it at that time because of it looked strange. It looked different, and I never had a very good relationship with any poetry I'd heard before. But this had some intrigue to me. Now when I look at it, what I like about poetry is it triggers something in me. And I never know what that's going to be. But when I look at this now or listen to it now, it's better to listen to it than to read it for me, frankly. I'm much closer to Mr. Death now than I was in grade school. And it triggers, and I actually have blue eyes. And it triggers to me looking back at the rest of my life and saying, was it any better than it was now? Or is it worse now than it was then? And so it's kind of like taking me with the process. It's taking, it's touching me somehow, and it's asking me something about myself that I need to answer.
I did not grow up reading poetry. I mean, I went to a grade school that didn't have a library until I was in the fifth grade. But when I read this, if I did not know that Buffalo Bill had beautiful blue eyes, and I read this, I might read it as a suicide note.
Yeah, maybe so. It's interesting.
And I just noticed that the only grammatical thing is the apostrophe S. Nothing else has any type of commas, periods, hyphens. Yeah, Janelle just told me that.
Yeah, I do think that, again, I remember my teachers, and what about this Jesus in here? And she's, and you know, with, I think it's kind of like of a slur, and you know, and you know, and I was, I don't know if I should say that even, and you know, and she said, well, you know, it is kind of a slur, but it's, you're thinking of it in the wrong way because it's the right word. It's what is the most holy word of great gravity to express your exasperation or your awe at this moment, and it's Jesus. He was a handsome man. Those are some interesting thoughts. I'll move on from this and just ask, you know, how do we know when something's a poem? You know, how do you know it's a poem? Like, go ahead and go up there one more slide. Like, for example, is this a poem? Is it? But what is it? It's a, how do you know it's a receipt? Just the format. The format. Yeah. Like. Go up one more slide, Nolan. Is this a receipt? Yeah. It's the same information, but formatted like a letter. And it took me a long time to type that up. Yeah. But thanks. But form, you know, is a key factor in recognizing what something is or isn't. You know, we could see a news article, and no one has to explain to us what it is, or a letter. And the content does matter. This doesn't work very well as a letter or as a receipt, and telling us, you know, the facts of what happened at the register 2 years ago. That's a real receipt I found, too, from 2 years ago. Please go up one more slide, Nolan. And so, stopping by woods on a snowy evening, we'll read this, and then we can kind of wrap up. And I do have slides, the next couple of slides, so that this is easier to see. But I just wanted to put it on the page because the way a poem looks on a page does matter. And so it's, you know, four lines, four stanzas, or quatrains, or whatever. I don't know. I get really annoyed with, like, poetic technical terms. So that's the only time I'll probably do that, like quatrain. So what? What is that? Who cares? And why a train? I don't know. But the qua I get. But I thought it would be neat to have one poem that we reflect on through the course of, you know, each session and see how it may become different for us by the end. And this one's a really good poem. Robert Frost said that he thought that this would be the poem from which he was remembered by. I think that probably the Road Not Taken has surpassed this one, but he said he wrote it in about 20 minutes. But Nolan, please go to the next slide, and we'll finish this up. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark, and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. So we'll just leave that where it is, and I'll try and have some printouts next time so that you can see these poems more easily. So I think we're done. Yeah.